History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. We've realized they don't have to go untold as long as we're willing to ask a few questions and invest some time to listen as memories from long ago take on new meaning in the here and now. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in the process, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we find ourselves inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And boy, are we in for some stories today with World War II veteran Ed Bates, who just turned 98. He would go on to a long career in law enforcement, even elected multiple times as sheriff in California's Madera County. But in World War II, he served first in the Merchant Marine, then in the Navy. Let's have him start us off with his childhood in Modesto, California.
Well, it was during the Depression. Wall Street guys were jumping out of their Wall Street apartments to kill themselves. Things were that bad. And my dad and his brother owned a blacksmith shop, and the farmers couldn't pay them. So they would go out and work on farms and get paid with crops. So he would come home, my dad would come home with a pickup load of carrots, and that's what we ate. We ate carrots fried, boiled, cooked in stew, and everything you can think of. And by the time I was 9 years old, I had a route in Modesto, going door to door on every Saturday, mowing people's lawns. I could make 5 cents for mowing the front lawn, 5 cents for making the back lawn. That gave me 10 cents. And I thought at the time, this is a great system. All I have to do is go out and find somebody that'll hire me. And if I work and they give me money, I thought that was the greatest thing that ever happened. So that's my earliest memories. And then, of course, by the time I was 11, I had two sisters. They were older than I. My dad was concerned about what I was going to do when I got in high school, if this depression was going to continue. He was concerned about my education. And his older sister was a teacher in Honolulu, Hawaii. And so was her husband. So they worked the deal. We had too many children and no money. And they had money and no children. So I found myself on a steamship alone, going over to Hawaii at a ball. Lived over there with them until just prior to World War II. Everybody in Hawaii knew that the war was coming with Japan. One of the common jokes when my aunt and uncle were playing bridge with other people, everybody had a gardener, a Japanese gardener, and a house person. The joke was, lady of the house said, "Tanaka, when the war comes, you wouldn't harm Missy, would you?" And his answer was, "No, no, no, Missy, that's the gardener's job." So that everybody knew it was coming. All my friends, their fathers were officers in the Navy. So I spent a lot of my time. I was on the USS Arizona, for example. I was on the submarine Argonaut that later went down with all hands. His dad was commanding officer, my buddy. So everybody knew the war was coming. So I went back home to do my junior year in high school. But I saw on November 3rd, 1941, I was finishing my junior year in high school. I turned 16. The next month, the war broke out. So I forged a Bible, hitchhiked up to San Francisco, told my parents I was going to get a summer job with another relative up in the foothills of Napa County, but tried to join the Marines. But I made a mistake. I wrote in the front of this book in old brown ink, "Born this day to Sun." I dated it 1923, which would have made me 18. But this Marine sergeant happened to look through it, asked me if I believed in miracles. And I said, "Well, yeah, I'm a Christian. I believe in miracles." He said, "Well, your dad filled this out when you were born?" I said, "Yes." He said, "Well, it says you were born in 1923. But the Bible wasn't printed until 1936. He said, "What do you say about that?" I said, "It's a miracle." He said, "No, you come back in 2 years." I said, "I'm not coming back in 2 years. Our forces are getting beat everywhere. Bataan Death March, Wake Island, everything. Our flight, our Navy had been defeated at Pearl Harbor. I said, I'm going in now. So he sent me across the street. It wasn't really a recruiting. You just went over and got your seaman papers as a merchant seaman. And 7 days later, I had my papers, and I was on a steamship going out to the Pacific, carrying munitions underneath the San Francisco Bay Bridge. I had been an Eagle Scout, so I knew the compasses. I knew how to box a compass. That's all the points. And I could splice line, tie knots. And when they asked me, well, have you shipped out before? I said, yes, on the SS Lurline. Where did you go? I said, well, went over the Hawaiian Islands and back. I didn't tell them I was 11 years old. So I found myself aboard ship, and there we were. So I spent my time in the Pacific unloading supplies, and then we went through the Panama Canal, going over to Guantanamo Bay, which is a big naval base at that time, and still is. German submarines were operating almost without any opposition. This was just 7 months after the war broke out. Sinking ships, they sunk in the month of July, August, and September of 1942. Just in the South Atlantic alone, they sunk 93 ships. It was just open stuff. So anyway, to make a long story short, when our ship had to go into Tampa, Florida, and have some repairs done, I jumped ship and joined the Navy. By that time, I was 17, and they were glad to take a guy who was already an experienced seaman.
Well, and I want to come back to that moment, but I don't want to miss something that happened in the midst of that, because you shared with us at 11 years old, you go by yourself to Hawaii, you spend the next several years there, you leave not long before the attack on Pearl Harbor, and you told us you'd been on the Arizona, you'd been on the Argonaut, you'd been around all these sailors in Pearl Harbor. So I'm just curious what it was like for you when you heard that news that Pearl Harbor had been attacked and so many lives had been lost.
Well, I wondered whether some of my friends, were killed. One of my high school friends, his father was a chief petty officer on a ship. So he had just bought a brand new 1941 Chevrolet Club Coupe. He got in it to go down to get to his ship, and it was machine gunned. He jumped out, made it to the ship, but the ship was sunk. And I talked to my friend, who later became an officer in the U.S. Air Force, Army Air Corps at that time. He took his little sister and put her in a washing machine and put the top on. That was the only place he could think of to try to protect her. So that's why, as soon as the war broke out, I wasn't going to wait. I had already contacted Governor Olson, who was governor of the state of California at that time, through my father, and the local congressman, who I think his name was Jerrison, had made arrangements that as soon as I finished my senior year, I was going to Annapolis. And I said, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to go over there and kill Japanese soldiers and sailors.
And a lot of guys have shared with me where they were when they found out the attack on Pearl Harbor had happened. Do you have a memory of that, of where you were and how you heard it?
It was on a Sunday. Times were tough, as I told you. I had a friend of mine that had a car. He was a senior. We got our .22 rifles and went up in the foothills to kill cottontails, rabbits. He had a radio in his car. We heard about it, so we went right back home quick. Right away, the military put out a broadcast. Anybody between the ages of 15, I think, and 45 or something, 50, who had a rifle, they wanted us to go down to the Modesto Airport, which was just a little, at that time, no commercial stuff, to join the State Guard. They wanted us to guard Don Pedro Dam and also the railroad against sabotage. So I went down there. They swore us in. I had my rifle. I had a 30-30 Winchester saddle rifle, a box of ammunition, and I said, what are we supposed to do? The sergeant said, in the State Guard, at that time I think they called it State Militia, but anyway, he said, well, if you see any Japanese paratroopers, shoot them. I said, okay. Well, nothing ever, but of course I went into service then, so I was later on, I was up in the Aleutian Islands on an island. I got a letter from the State Guard, said, you have failed to report for duty. We've tried to contact you 3 or 4 times, and if you don't report next Sunday or Saturday or whenever it was, we'll send the military police out to get you. So I sent them back a letter and said, please do.
Yeah, it's all relative. You know, you mentioned some of the jokes in Hawaii about, you know, well, that's the gardener's job and all of that. But then you come back to the States, and I know you weren't here too long, But I'm just curious, did you have any friends in California or Hawaii who were Japanese American?
Indeed, I did. And I thought it was very strange that the government would cause people of Japanese ancestry here in California, for example, to be sent to relocation places. One of my friends in Hawaii had asked me if he came to Modesto, because there was a famous guy at Modesto High School who was a leader in following Sousa's band, which was a national boys band, and he was a trumpet player. And he said, I have a chance to be trained with this man. And Modesto, he said, are people there prejudiced? I said, oh, of course not. No way. So he came over. His family stayed in Hawaii. They didn't impress them. But he got called in and put in a camp. It was a strange situation. Now, on the other hand, I understand what was happening. In San Francisco, the papers reported, at least, that any Asian walking down the street was being attacked, whether they were Filipino or Chinese or Indonesian or whatever they were. It was dangerous for them. I talked to my father. His grandfather on one side was from Germany, and so his grandmother was too on that side. And during World War I, people would come up and throw yellow paint at their house and stuff, just because they had a German last name. So people react emotionally in different ways. But you have to understand that this was such a sudden attack. Most people in the Midwest and places like that, in little towns, never heard of Pearl Harbor, didn't know what they were talking about. So it was a bad time, and I suppose we're having it right now. So some people, for whatever reasons, escapes me, are prejudiced about that kind of thing. It doesn't bother me a bit. I've learned in the service that you can only respect people on what they do and not what they look like.
I know we're bouncing around. Let's go back to this 16-year-old that's in the Merchant Marine. And you told us how many ships had been sunk by U-boats. Were you afraid? Were you concerned that that could happen to your ship?
I didn't have enough brains to be concerned about anything. I thought it was a great, great adventure. One ship did get sunk alongside of us. The only thing that bothered me was we didn't have any escorts. We didn't have any guns. So the reason this ship was en route through the Panama Canal, we were en route to Philadelphia Naval Yard to have a naval gun crew put aboard and guns put on. And so we went into Tampa, Florida first from Cuba in order to have quarters placed for this Navy gun crew. We had an old 30 caliber Lewis machine gun from World War I. That's the only weapon we had, and I fired it. And it was so, the barrels were burned out so bad that every fifth round is a tracer, so you can trace where your bullets are going. This one would go shoot out maybe 100 yards, and then they were in all directions. There wasn't nothing to shoot at anyway, except torpedoes, and they were underneath the water. So, no, I wasn't afraid. And for whatever reasons, I now believe that it was because I was under the protection of Jesus Christ. But at the time, I didn't believe that. I just believed that I was, nothing could happen to me. And I believed that all through law enforcement. Guys used to say, Ed, you're crazy to go charging into those places. We didn't have SWAT teams in those days. Crazy things happened during wars.
It's time for our first break, but when we come back, a crazy thing Ed Bates did that would lead to the most important relationship in his life. You can find photos and a short video with this newly minted 98-year-old at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook, and we'll come right back after this. Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 1,800 veterans will have seen their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.